that, Peter. Let's we're gonna shift gears a bit. That the last little stanza of that song is really essentially the whole thing that I'm trying to do in my little speech that I'm gonna make. Both the let's see if Stephen's still up there. It's about trusting in God and even weak being strong because of the work of Jesus. That's the shortened version of what we get into when we're talking about the trust fail. It's some deep stuff when we start talking about trust or building or rebuilding trust. It gets into some painful areas or potentially dangerous areas. But first, we're going to kind of, before we kind of get into those heart areas, we're going to stay a little more basic, a little more, or a little less tender of a territory. And let me just tell you a little bit about what we're trying to do this whole season here. When we're talking about confronting failure, we want to learn about failure, but there's just a funny thing about us living in this day and age is there's this sort of obsession with failure as this kind of funny thing. And, you know, there's numerous blogs and websites that get into failure, and it's like, ha, ha, ha. Somebody snapped a picture of someone doing something stupid, and now we can all kind of laugh at them and basically minimalize it and say, like, well, everybody fails sometimes. Just don't get caught and don't get made fun of. But what I'm hoping for this season is we get into a space where God can even transform the way that we see failure into how God sees it, which are opportunities for Christ's light to shine brighter and opportunities for redemption. Let's keep in mind how God sees our weaknesses or our failures. When the Apostle Paul was writing to the church in Corinth in what we know as 2 Corinthians chapter 12, he describes this in his own relationship with God around this thing that he's been struggling with, and he says that God said to him that my grace is sufficient for you. My power or my strength is made perfect in weakness. So even when we're struggling with trust, when we're struggling with failure, just remember that God's doing something beyond you doing something dumb. And there's nothing so dumb that you could do, or there's no failure that you could make so amazingly that God couldn't use it for something good. So to kind of, to get us thinking about that, I want to use a funny blog that I like a lot. It's called Monday Through Friday, which you might or may not be familiar with, but Nathan and I like it, and it's about work-related stuff. So if you have a job, some of these you might be able to relate to more. Like, you know, so much of work is being at work, but there's this other thing that makes it all more interesting, which is the commute. And some days just your commute and how it goes can make a difference on how the entire day happens, because some days you're going to get onto your commute in your convertible and get right before an overpass where there are two possibly full porta potties that might eclipse you. This is kind of what the website is full of, you know. It's full of, you know, notes that people write at jobs. And several of you have worked with me over the years. We make agreements very early on. We don't write salty notes. We don't have conflict over post-its and things like that. Or we don't improperly use quotation marks in our salty notes that have to do with, you know, please do not use staples for posting, because somebody might just call you out on your bad punctuation, even to say something, please do not in italics for emphasis. Yes, don't use quotation marks for emphasis. But a lot of us, though, we have unique struggles to this in this day and age. Especially there's the next one is called first world problems. You know, first world used to be an political term, because it had to do with the first world and second world. It had to do with the United States and the free countries, the capitalist ones, and then with the Soviet Union and the second world, you know. But now it's more of a economic term. But for us in the first world, we have unique problems. Like, I guess you have to really be a nerd to fully appreciate this, but when you have to use certain web browsers at work, this one says that this woman is hysterical because she has to use Internet Explorer at work. And just so you know, we would never do that around here. And if you're not familiar with computers, Internet Explorer is the worst web browser time and time again, yet people are forced to use it. All right, most of these funny things, though, center around the bathroom, so I hope you'll pardon just potty humor, like literally. But sometimes it's not even like in the bathroom that what could be so funny, but it could be like certain bathrooms that are mutants only. And people start modifying things. So like the bosses or the company puts out something that's like normal, and people working together start kind of rallying to make it a little more fun. Sometimes that might mean going to the bathroom together with your friends so you can have a chat. Sometimes it's removing the walls that might keep the workers apart in what you're trying to do. Or it might be artwork that you do while in there that helps pass the time or helps the person who's following you enjoy themselves. Or just kind of putting up new signs that you know that the bosses didn't put out there, that just all employees are required to moonwalk out of this bathroom. When Borders went out of business two months ago or something, there was a whole line. This website went crazy because people just had all these Borders books. You know, this chain bookstore dying was just like the best thing for the nerds ever. And some of the things that they did was just even change little signs. And if you can't read it, it says, invisibility cloaks 50% off original price. There was another one that I had to edit these down, and it was like what appeared to be an empty shelf, and it was a sign that said, free air guitars, please take one, you know, and that kind of stuff. I'm into it. But the last one, too, is sometimes the people get together to subvert. I'm talking, I know, about the bosses, and you have mixed feelings about that. Some of you are even in positions where you're the boss sometimes. I don't mean like that. But, you know, when mega corporations are trying to take us over and they advertise us, sometimes the witty get busy and can even take big swipes at, companies like Walmart and change the truck where it says, Walmart, we sell for Satan always. Which some of you, you know, have strong feelings about that. So, you know, when it comes down to what do these have to do with trust, you know, there's a very loose connection. And but really what it's about is just kind of understanding what we think is funny. You know, we think, oh yeah, there's something out there, we change it a little bit. But that kind of builds a bond even of the people in your office or the people that you live with in your dorm or your house or whatever. But when it gets down to trust, a lot of times there's these messages that even like Walmart tells us that, and whether or not you trust them becomes something relevant to us that we're going to work with. Because trust is sort of a finicky thing. It's not very simple in most circumstances, although generally it is pretty simple. Most of our time is either spent relying on trust and taking it for granted, or it's spent building it up or rebuilding it. Destroying trust takes very little time. It's very easy to do with very little effort. I do a lot of counseling with couples, especially people get married or people who recently got married, and I talk with them a lot about trust and intimacy as things that you're really going for in your relationship, because that's when we find the fullness of what it means to have this connection, and it's kind of like that with God too, right? Just having trust with God where you know God trusts you, or knowing that you trust God and you have this intimate connection, that kind of helps the whole universe make sense, and especially in difficult situations. Learning how to trust or how to trust again can be difficult and painful. I tell these couples that trust is something that takes a long time to build, but it takes very little time to knock down. It's kind of like building with those toy alphabet blocks, you know? And for me, it was I have an older brother who I was the bane of his existence for a few months or years, I'm not really the bane of his existence anymore. But he was obsessed with these blocks, making these elaborates, you know, in his mind, he's working forever on, which is like 7 minutes, you know, but like working forever on building this replica of the famous face of, you know, El Capitan out of these blocks, and in comes like stupid 2-year-old version of me, just kind of like, slashes it and just smiles at him like, hey man, I'm here, you know? Like, what's going on? Trust is kind of like that. It takes a long time to build it up. It gets smashed really quickly, especially when it's made of small building blocks. And when it's the kind of trust that I think God wants to teach us, we're using some different materials and even maybe, if you can imagine, bigger blocks that not only don't get knocked over as easy, but they don't don't take quite as long to regenerate. And the trust that we're hoping to glean from the Holy Spirit is something that's a bit more sturdy and stronger. But the relevant questions today are going to be, who do we trust? Where do we put our trust? And likewise, who puts their trust in us? And those two questions can inform the way we read this story about Samson. We're going to be able to learn a lot to our situation. You'll probably have to make some connections that I don't make. And a lot of that is because the story is just so interesting and full, and it doesn't make a ton of sense if you don't have some of what Samson was about and what he went through before. But I want to explore what happens when our trust is put in the wrong place, as we're often tempted to do. Discerning who we put that trust in, especially when it's fragile, is hard work. We need to develop a stronger trust that's not as easily broken. So here's some background stuff with Samson. I think most people understand who he was, maybe, or what he was into. I want to kind of make a case that Samson was basically like one of the craziest mass murderers of the last 3,000 or 4,000 years, and make this case just by the facts that's easy enough to see, so that we can basically forget that and look beyond. One of my favorite movies says, if you would look beyond your literal mind, you'd be able to see what I'm talking about here. But Samson's story is going to be crazy. But you have to get beyond just the facts of it to understand what God might be working with, especially how to learn from it. It's got to be beyond what are merely the events. So here's who Samson is. The people put their trust in him. He was one of the judges of Israel. He was actually the third to the last one. So he was part of this process where once the Hebrew people in exile on the Exodus got to the Promised Land, they still had no centralized government. Okay? They had no warrior class. They had no standing army. That made them a unique people in that part of the world, especially in juxtaposition to several different groups who they have conflict with and who have different waves of oppression. Particularly today, we're talking about the Philistines and their walled cities and their raiding parties. And whenever in the Old Testament especially, you start to get these images of walled cities, that doesn't mean that just like this great work of architecture, these smart people who built walls, who had these cool gates, those are always linked in these stories to the slavery and oppression that it calls to make them, and they're always sucking in from outside of them. And when there's a people that come in there to their land, they're a threat not only to their way of life, but could even be a threat to their security, because they're sort of obsessed with security. They live in the middle of the desert and they're building 30-foot high walls. You know, it's kind of bizarre. Anyway, Samson's called, like others were before him and a few after him, to lead during a time of crisis. Those leaders weren't always contiguous. There was gaps where they didn't need judges, but they came and they were, a lot of times, they were specifically military leaders who would even call to raise a temporary army full of men and women who would lead and who would serve and who would fight against the oppression. During this period, we call it Judges 13 to 15. A lot of people call it 1081 BC. Is when this story is happening. So the first couple chapters, the 13, 14, and 15, I want to do in like two big paragraphs and then read, you know, most of 16. Samson's parents were visited when God was, according to their understanding, was punishing Israel for their infidelity and allowed them to fall into the hands of the Philistines and their walled cities and raiding parties. An angel came to Manoah and his wife, who could not conceive, came to them twice in these two different, very dramatic encounters that ended up at the end of it with this blood sacrifice, where the angel took his staff and lit the thing on fire and flew away in this really interesting way. And this pledge that their child would not only be born, but would be the liberator of them against the Philistines. Now, Samson's future mom would have to put down the booze And Samson would take a Nazarite vow from birth. And number 6 breaks this out more clearly, but it's basically the Nazarite vow. You're not going to mess with fermented drinks or intoxicating beverages. You're going to have limits about your interaction with dead people and cemeteries and graves. You're going to have to avoid them. And the other thing that Samson's most known for is you have to not cut the hair on your heads. In fact, many of us around here may be known for that a little bit, but not in as intense of a way. Now, Samson, not all Nazarites grow up to have such legendary strength as Samson did. He's just sort of like, and these stories may have even grown a little bit, but the dude was super strong, and he had no inhibitions, and he went and he used his strength. We got to remember who his role was. He was supposed to be leading and raising this army to fight the oppressors, and much of his story has to do with him fighting and murdering because of his own side disputes and his personal problems. He was going to marry a Philistine woman, which, by the way, when he talked to his parents about marrying this Philistine woman, who's essentially the oppressor of them, they were saying, like, no, this is a bad idea, and he insists, I'm the leader person, not you, Dad, or whatever. I'm the judge, not you, Mom. And he gets in there, and he tries to do it, and he ends up killing an Asiatic lion with his bare hands, and he has this, when he comes back to it later, there's honey in the skull and all this kind of, like, intense poetry that comes out of that. But his future wife, basically what happens is she's coerced into giving the answer to this riddle that he gives his 30 groomsmen the eve of their wedding as this kind of like stupid bet. Now they're so freaked out by this bet that's basically over money or wealth that they force her to give them the answer. And when Samson finds out, he goes and kills 30 Philistines to get their clothes, because that's what the bet was, 30 sets of new clothes, and then he hands them over to the Philistines. So just don't think of that as like a good idea, okay? You lose a bet, you go kill 30 dudes. Okay, that's kind of how Samson is like that. And then this whole rivalry turned up where he goes back to finally get married, and his would-be father-in-law gave his would-be wife to the best man in marriage, and this causes a feud, which Samson's family's taken a hit a little bit. Samson comes back with 300 foxes, lights their tails on fire, and sets them loose through the villages of the Philistines. Right, you know the story of Samson, but you're looking at me like, what? I mean, yeah, this is wild stuff. And who dies when you burn villages with foxes whose tails are on fire? It's usually either your oldest, least mobile people or your youngest, least mobile people. And then the foxes get hurt too. And don't think we didn't notice that, Samson. What's that? Firefox, huh? Indeed. So basically the climactic moment of this is Judah's army is getting put together. They even got 3,000 strong, which is an extraordinary amount of a fighting force. But the armies of the Philistines show up. And it doesn't even say how many there were, apparently they're dwarfing the size of Samson's army. And they say, this guy's gone too far, hand him over. And they say, okay. They tie him up in ropes and hand him over. As soon as they do, he busts free, grabs the jawbone of a donkey, and kills 1,000 soldiers. Not like farmers with pitchforks. These are dudes that are going to have armor and training, and they have a standing army. And Samson goes bonkers on them. The ability to do that takes more than just strength, to make that kind of statement. And it doesn't say what losses his forces sustained, but you've seen Brad Pitt movies, right, where he just starts wreaking havoc through the masses or whatever. You watch Brad Pitt movies. You're kind of like, I haven't seen that one. Yeah, I bet. Everybody wants to see Moneyball all of a sudden. And it's like, it's about baseball. You're like, what? What? I thought Brad Pitt was in it. Yeah, Brad Pitt's in it. He plays a general manager, not a player. It looks good, though. It's like, okay. I'll go with you, I guess. Brad Pitt. So anyway, the last thing that happens that's really interesting in the beginning of chapter 16 is he goes, again, just think of his role, right? The leader of the nation. He goes into one of the walled cities and spends the night with a Philistine sex worker. And that night, the Philistine, like sort of secret police, military elite kind of people, do this. They set up an ambush for him outside the gates where they're like, at dawn, we're gonna nail this dude. He comes out, rips the doors off of the city, including the bar, takes them up a hill and plants them in a certain mocking way. You know, you're thinking about like your house, or you're thinking probably of doors, like, you know, interior doors in RDA rehabbed homes in Philadelphia, like mine, they weigh about 1 pound because they're like balsa wood. If you go like that with your finger, you put your whole finger through it, you know, these light doors. That's not what we're talking about here, okay? We're talking about the deforestation trees that get turned in with iron into these, you know, probably at least 10 or 15 feet high, 10 feet wide, and there's two of them, and he's ripping them off. So this dude is like out of his gourd strong, and he uses it for all these bizarre reasons. So that happens, and this is kind of where we get. You see what we're dealing with here. The nation puts its trust in Samson, the strong and the brave, and he's repeatedly chasing after Philistine women, which put him in a bizarre place, yet he somehow still kind of get some insurrection going for the deliverance of the people like was prophesied about him. Rather than reading all of chapter 16, what I'd rather do is give you the gist, and you can read it more, but I'll get to the certain parts that are very relevant to us today. Hold on a second. Because you, I think, know how this goes. I'll start with verse 4. I'll skip ahead, and then I'll tell you where I pick up. But this is verse 4. Sometime later, Samson fell in love with a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah. The rulers of the Philistines went to her and said, "See if you can lure him into showing you the secret of his great strength and how we can overpower him so that we may tie him up and subdue him. Each one of us will give you 1,100 shekels of silver." So Delilah said to Samson, "Tell me the secret of your great strength and how you could be tied up and subdued." Just her process is pretty plain, you know? It doesn't even say, like, they're just like, "We'll each give you 1,100 shekels." It doesn't say whether she haggled with them or said, "No, I love Samson. No, he loves me. I wouldn't do that to somebody who loves me." You just basically get the idea. She was like, okay, probably poor, probably doesn't have a lot of resources. Probably even understands who Samson is, you know, who went and killed 30 dudes because he lost a bet, or killed 1,000 people to make a point to the armies of her people. So anyway, so she might, you know, and I just want to maybe say this too, because we generally think of Delilah as this just like super sexy, seductive temptress who has this big, huge plot. She's not really the mastermind behind any of this, okay? So she's probably a casualty who's caught up in doing something that she wouldn't really be behind, other than she needed the money. And we all have done stupid things because we needed the money. So I just want to, I know maybe it's weird, but like, let's not get too down on Delilah, other than just how kind of, I don't know, she has no tact. Because basically they're going to give her money to what? Find out how to subdue Samson? So she goes, okay, walks up to Samson and says, "Hey, how do I subdue you and tie you up so that you can't get out?" Like, phrase it in a different way, you know, like, or somehow, like, be more subtle, you know, but this is what she does, and she does this three different times, and he tells her, like, these weird things: take fresh bowstrings that have never been used, tie me up with them. She does it in the middle of the night. Philistines are in the room, and she wakes him up. He gets up, breaks him free, and she's like, "Hey, you lied to me," and he's like, "Okay." And she's like, "Well, what does it really take to subdue you?" So at this point, like, you got to think Samson's getting the idea that she's not just asking him because she wants to know him better. She's asking him this because she's going to hand him over to the bad guys, in our reading of the story. So she does it two more times, and he says something like, "Oh, if you took ropes that were brand new and never used before, I would be as weak as every other man." And then she does it. And then it wakes him up. And then, you know, and he, again, wreaks havoc on those dudes. She asks him again. And, you know, and he's just kind of like, you know, this is you're a great girlfriend. You know, like, we have so much fun together, you know? Or maybe he just likes showing off and being so strong. Or maybe he just likes that she's interested in him. She asks him interesting questions that nobody else will ask. You know, I'm thinking about myself, but I could also think about just friends over the years who like talk about the reason that they're dating the wrong person. And they say things like that, you know, like, it's just so honest with me. And I tell them things that I couldn't tell anybody else. Some things you shouldn't tell anybody else. Like if God gave you superhuman strength, don't reveal the source to the wrong person. You know, like there's limits even for honesty in a dating relationship. And then finally what it comes down to, she's real mad at him, nags him all day. And in verse, what is it? This is just phrased so beautifully. That verse 16, with such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was tired to death. So then he told her everything because he was tired to death. No razor has ever been on my head, he said, because I have been a Nazarite dedicated to God from my mother's womb. If my head were shaved, my strength would leave me and I would become as weak as any other man. And Delilah saw that he had told her everything. She told the rulers this time, okay, I know the deal. They bring the money. And then she has somebody cut his hair after he falls asleep on her lap. And finally, again, she says, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. And this is verse 20. He awoke from his sleep and thought, I'll go out as before and shake myself free. But he did not know that the Lord had left him. Then the Philistines seized him, gouged out his eyes with their swords, and took him down to Gaza. Binding him with bronze shackles, they set him to grinding grain in the prison. But the hair on his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. And that just last sentence there is such beautiful writing. And isn't that just how God works when we get in these binds, when we do the stupidest stuff, when we let ourselves be betrayed, the metaphorical head that gets shaved that shouldn't have been, the hair starts growing like immediately. On one level, this story is about being careful who you put your trust in. And we should be careful about that. At another level, it's realizing who puts their trust in you. This is not a story about a woman seducing and betraying a man as if that's like the only way that this trust fail ever works. But it's about struggling with living in community and having a mission. So one basic question would be, who do you let influence you? Because there's conflicting messages all the time. For instance, does anybody besides me listen to sports talk radio? Okay. Earlier meeting, there was nobody, man. And I was just like, whoa. This is like, I didn't realize I was such a Martian amongst humans, I guess. Martian amongst earthlings. But basically in Philadelphia, so maybe you'll enjoy this. Maybe you didn't know that such a thing existed. But there's two different sports talk radio stations, okay? And WIP, ESPN Radio. Now, the interesting thing to me about them in terms of trust has to do with whether they're sponsored by Verizon or sponsored by Comcast. You understand Comcast and Verizon, right? Do you have internet? Okay, I'm just making sure that you get this. So let's do ESPN first. They're sponsored by Verizon. They even have Ryan Howard doing a Fios commercial on the radio. Ryan Howard, he's a guy on the Philadelphia Phillies baseball team that we all like. So it's like, wow, he's down with Fios? And then one time after a Fios ad, I heard a little ad that Verizon was running that said, to our loyal customers and friends, we just want to let you know that we're negotiating right now with union representatives at Verizon to make sure that we can all together come to a mutually beneficial solution in terms of, you know, the crisis that we were having about benefits. And it's like, oh, that's some Verizon. They negotiate with the union. I kind of like them, you know? And if you listen to WIP, they're Comcast sponsored. So they're all Comcast-tastic. And they do all these, their ads I don't like as much, you know, and they don't have no Ryan Howard, you know, and they just do their kind of thing. And I personally, I left Comcast, you know, so I have this in my mind that even their advertising is going to be annoying. However, then they pulled an ad out about Verizon too. And I switch between these radio stations when there's a commercial, you know what I mean? And what they say about Verizon is, you know, it was one of those like, did you know that Verizon not only is trying to break strikes, but is taking the pension from hard-earned Verizon workers and throwing it down the toilet. While the last 5 years, Verizon CEOs have made $500 million. You know, and it kind of goes in this sort of expose commercial about how terrible of a company Verizon is to work for. So if you're me, just trying to listen to sports when you're driving 20 minutes or whatever the situation is, you get these conflicting messages, and who do you trust? Fios? Comcast? Verizon, not Verizon, you know, and it can be very confusing, but most people are going to let someone influence you, and most of us, if we want to have internet, make that choice between Comcast and Verizon. And some of you out-of-the-box people are already thinking in the back of your mind, I don't choose either. I steal my neighbor's internet, you know, and God bless you. And then some of you even more are back there, I don't steal it. I ask them for the password, you know, and you're just like, so they're not stealing it. Thank you. Thanks for showing us how to mooch our whole lives. Yeah. And how to, no, not, sorry, we're not mooching. We're not mooching. We're defying the corporations, right? Whatever. I give a bunch of my neighbor my signal, and I give them the password. I don't care. But just, it was a point about trust. Yeah. One big point is understand how God sees you. And the biggest problem for Samson is that he doesn't understand how important he is to the rest of the community. When he gives over his secrets to Delilah, that's not just this little pillow talk whispering what your secret fantasies are for when you're 60 years old can be. He's giving over Israel's greatest weapon against the oppressor because it's him. He doesn't realize how important he is to the other people. And the thing about trust, especially in a community with a mission like us, is that most of the time the problem is we don't understand how God sees us and how important we are to other people. So when we're ready to kind of give it up to the, you know, the Delilahs of the world, it's not because we just want to give it up or we want to not be trustworthy, but it's because we don't see ourselves as valuable as we are. Another thing for some of us is once we have a sense of community, once you've been part of, say, the church for a long time, you already have good friends that have been your friends for a few years, you found your mate, you found your house, you kind of have all the things that you once aspired to or you once looked for in a church. It's really hard at that point to continue on the mission, to even see yourself as valuable to other people, because you could say, you know, what do I contribute? I'm kind of all set over here. And for Samson, he was sort of all set. He was all set and had his needs met to the point where he starts having these bizarre appetites for Philistine women and going into their cities at night when he needs to be with his own people, figuring out how they're going to survive the next winter. I mean, you get like the problem with Samson. It's not just that, you know, he loved the ladies. What are you going to do? He's Samson. He's super strong. The problem that gets into it, like so many of us, is our greatest strengths also cast the biggest shadows. And with Samson, his great strength, he relied on it too much. And when that was gone, what did he have left? You know, he was out in the wrong part of town at the wrong time, surrounded by the wrong friends. I could go into this for a bit, but let's just leave it at one sentence. For the prospect of love, many young people will do just about anything. For us, maybe we could have learned from some of the Samson moments of like discerning your new friends well. When he was going to go get married to this Philistine lady, his family was kind of like, that's not a good idea. And he says, you know, I know what I'm doing. I'm a big boy now. And he gets into all this nonsense. With friends, you know, are you helping to be an influence for Jesus, or are you being influenced by them to just hang out, tell lies, tell secrets, and be rushed out into captivity with your eyes gouged out by swords? You know, but like so often it's the sort of the new friend that I think we need to discern about And this is kind of typical from me in 10th grade. You know, the new kid, I went to a small high school. Mostly it was the same kids every year. 10th grade, a new kid came along, and he was kind of a bad boy, and he was the coolest kid in school. Pretty much everybody wanted to hang out with him and be like him, or date him, depending. You know that story, right? And it's like, you kind of want to be like them. Or it's like the person who's been this faithful Christian their whole life. They go to college. They take philosophy 101. The teacher in the first day says, the Council of Nicaea was set up by Constantine as a social control method. Christianity is a bunch of crap. And then they go home saying, oh my God, oh my God. Council of Nicaea, dude. Everything that we've done, it's bogus. And it's like, well, who told you that? My teacher. They would never give me their own opinion of or unprocessed feelings in class. I'm like, yeah, they would. And why do you like trust them all of a sudden? And some of you are hanging back there, smug. It wasn't philosophy 101 my freshman year. It was grad school sociology, you know. And it's kind of like, and there was a bigger conversation than that. You know, it's like, yeah, well, the new influence kind of shows up and dominates all of a sudden. And then your family, your friends, your community, or God, or any other connection you had, basically, you forget about because you're really into the new thing. And the shiny new thing is what Samson got way too into. Most of what he did could have been avoided if he talked about it with other people. Don't get caught on the other side of the line at night without talking to someone about it. It's really dangerous territory, and it's really difficult because we all have secret, weird little things that we do or think nobody knows about. First of all, God knows about it, and second of all, you are getting yourself into danger if you're not helping other people get in there and discern it with you, and Samson certainly was one of those people. This is kind of the end point here, but even when Samson basically was trusting in satisfying his own carnal urges more than his role with the people, God was still trustworthy. I don't think that God caused him to get jacked up. I think Samson did that on his own. But God is bigger than any of the tiny building blocks that kids knock down. God is there even when we don't deserve it. And there's more to this story that is kind of bizarre, but it still is a good capstone to even know how Samson's legacy got carried out. And finally, he's a captive by the Philistines, and there's this huge party where all of the Philistine leaders and rulers are going to get together, thousands of them in this huge structure. There's thousands of people partying on the roof, and they say, bring in Samson here to entertain us. So he comes in, and he's blind. He tells one of the servants of the house, put me along the pillars of the temple so that I might lean against them. That is kind of a stupid thing to comply with. Just out of your own, let's just make an agreement. If there's like some super strong enemy of ours that wants to hang out during a public meeting and like lean against the posts that hold the building up, even if they're blind, even if their head was shaved, just don't let them, okay? Just put them in like a safer area where like they're not going to kill us all. You know, it's just sort of like, it's a funny thing that the servant just does it though. And then he basically gets down to the point where he cries out to God. This is verse 28. He prayed to the Lord, Sovereign Lord, remember me. Please, God, strengthen me one more time. Let me with one blow get revenge on the Philistines for my two eyes. And Samson reached towards the pillars. He brings them all down and he says, let me die with the Philistines. And they all died. And this story says that he killed more with his death than he ever did alive. And there's another thing about that. Samson still doesn't get it. You know, what is he going to do with the Philistines, right? He's got all the leaders there. What does he want? I want freedom for my people, God. Give me one more, you know, burst of strength here. You know, I want to stop the oppression that's happening against, you know, your people that you brought into a promised land. No, he's still salty about his eyes. He's like, I want vengeance for my eyeballs. Let me kill a couple thousand people. You know, and again, remember, I said that in that barbaric voice because Samson was a barbarian, okay? Make no mistake about it. This is like 3,000 plus years ago. He's a desert wandering barbarian who picks up, you know, kills lions with his bare hands and goes slaughters 1,000 people with a bone. Him wanting to just bring the whole thing down and kill a couple thousand people was nothing unusual. But it could have been something more meaningful maybe, but also that dialogue in there, who knows what he was really saying, because I doubt somebody heard it and ran, and so they could write down the story. You know, it's like we're reading into it. That's kind of the person that Samson was. But even, you know, just first of all, today if he lived, he wouldn't be considered our hero. He would be considered a mass murderer. You get that, right? So even like as the heroes of the story, like, I mean, what's the death count at this point? I mean, this only says thousands of people, plus another 1,000, plus the 30, plus whoever he died in the villages, and then probably 300 foxes. You know, it's like, and besides other wild animals and stuff, like this dude was a killer, you know, unless, of course, so we would, you know, we would have a wanted poster on his face or something like that. Unless, of course, he was our guy and the people he was killing were hoarding all the natural resources in the Middle East or something like that. And then at that point, we'd be like, oh, Samson, yes, the USS Samson, you know, yes. Get us, we'll save that for another day. And sorry to touch on some tender issues there. I heard a couple of like, oohs, but either way, God made this his bonehead attempts of leadership, and he brought into some kind of deliverance. The Philistine oppression wasn't quite over, but it had been dealt a blow that they eventually would die from, in my opinion. There was a break in the oppression despite Samson's self-centered efforts. It's kind of how it goes. Despite our own self-centeredness and our own failures, God still wants to do something and is going to do it. Even uses us and even uses the weirdest people. But when we allow our trust to be put in the wrong places, like either, you know, I'm talking about the random teacher or the random person that you think you might date that has all this power and influence over you, when you give over your trust to them, when you give over your mind to them, it's a dangerous thing. And they might not be there to help you. They might actually be a predator, and they might be trying to destroy your people. And one of the things I love about Leota's place is, among other things, is that Blue puts together these great quotes. And this month, she's focusing on a hero that she and I both admire. And the most famous quote from this South African freedom fighter, Steve Biko, during the end of what was a long period of apartheid, as he said that the most potent weapon of the oppressor is the mind, the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. When you get over their minds, that's when you really have a hold on them. So that trust, rather than putting it into these weird places, we need to figure out how to put it into God and how to actually be part of a trusting community. And this is the last just couple bullets for application. Be the trust system. This, if you want to learn from Samson, be it. Don't just debate whether or not you want to put your trust into the institution of the church. I'll just simplify that for you. Don't do it. Don't put your trust in any institution, even the church. Don't. However, if you want to be the church, you can be it and fill it with trust. Don't let people convince you to keep damaging secrets, either about you or about someone else. It's dangerous soul territory, and that's abuse of trust. Trust that you have gifts and God can work through you, even with your own problems, serving and leading. There's a lot of change in leadership going on around here, and people are taking risks, becoming cell leader apprentices and cell leaders and joining music teams and cleaning teams, new staff positions. This is all good. Trust that that God might use you too. And the other humans around that are leading and serving, trust that they're humans, first of all, but also God does something through them despite their own weaknesses and failures. God's strength is most obvious when we're weak, not when we're these strong Samson slayer dudes. You know, when God's strength becomes more apparent when the slayer dude is humbled and blind and his head was shaved and he's out there as a circus clown for the powerful. God doesn't make us weak. God doesn't make us fail. But God does use failure as a place where Jesus shines the brightest. And when we let Jesus shine through our failures, the fullness of what God can do and of God's love that can transform people and bring hope is revealed. Thanks for listening so well. Let's have a brief moment of silence, and I'll lead us in a short prayer. God, thanks for moving and calling us to follow you and to trust you. We want to, and we want to move where you're moving. So continue to this healing process that we're in, and may we be a healing agent to others too, in Jesus' name, amen. So we got a few minutes here. Does anybody want to add some of your own anecdotes? Danielle, Jody, and Cameron. Yeah, I'm with you on a lot of those things because I think a lot of these stories aren't meant for kids.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they kind of are. And like,
yeah,
to just let them understand it as they do. Because the way we understand somebody killing 1,000 people is like, that's savage. At that point, like, you know, you can make arguments of like how many lives Samson saved by killing, you know, by stopping that army from their assault or something. So it's just a different time and maybe even a different level of morality before Jesus, and it's during a time where like there's a lot of wildness like that. So it's really hard to put those things together. So I think the key thing is to listen to what God's saying to us right now, not just even what the stories mean. Who will get to you, Peter? Unless you really got to get on that point?
Yeah.
Okay. What's up?
my nephew, a 3-year-old nephew that lives with my parents, my sister, and my parents, of course, bought them the picture Bible, and he's stuck on Jesus dying on the cross. It has pictures of Jesus dying on the cross. Why did he die? Why did he die? Why is he on the cross if he's God? Why? I don't know how to explain it to a 3-year-old. But he's stuck on it. So they hide the picture Bible from him now because he just keeps looking at it. Like, it used to be in the car. It used to be in next to his bed at nighttime. And now they hide it because he keeps asking why. Why did Jesus die?
I'm kind of stuck on that myself. No, I'm a grown-up. That's a cool story. Cameron?
This is my first Sunday doing, music, so it's also my first Sunday doing 5 and 7 o'clock, which has been interesting hearing the same speech twice. The first one, my reaction to the Afghanistan and Iraq war, comment was, ooh, cheap shot. And then, you said it again, and I was like, wait, this is actually a really relevant comparison. And then, in a weird way, kind of humanizing, and it's made me think about, the Bush administration, and sort of in a different way, he's this, man of God, and in this, sort of group of people that think they're, the chosen people of God, and they're putting their trust in him, and he does, all these things that, some would call savage and barbarian, supports all these things. I mean, it's not just him, obviously, it's a lot of people, but he's a useful figurehead, to talk about, it makes me wonder, I wonder if God worked through his actions, what's God, what is God doing, God did, I worked through Samson's selfishness, and I don't know, it's kind of uncomfortable to say that in a group full of progressive young people. it makes me wonder maybe it's too easy to demonize, and maybe I need to tell a little more faith in God, his ability to work through ignorance and barbaric actions.
Yeah. Well, we got to wrap it up at that point. Did God work through him? I think even in the Judges narrative, the answer is yes, in a lot of really interesting ways. The bigger answer, though, is God's still working through that story, and what happened there, we're still talking about it. We're still kind of getting some spiritual territory tilled for God to do some new stuff. So, you're like that, too, and the decisions you make maybe even now seem like, oh, man, that was just bad, bad, bad. But who knows? In a couple years, especially when you can even share about it on the other side, others glean from it too. God works despite any of our weirdness. Good stuff. We're going to do a few more things before we go, but that'll take probably 5 minutes or more like 8 minutes. But Vanessa is one of the cell leaders who's hosting tonight, and she's going to come and tell us some ways to connect. While she's coming up, would you take these binders at the ends of your rows? And if you would, fill out our welcome list as it comes by you. Let us know you were here. There's a little poll question there if you want. If you leave your contact info to help us to make a connection with you.
Thanks. Talking about kids and Bible stories, I just wanted to share. I was upstairs with the kids at the 5, and Lena and Dan were leading the time, and we read the story of Tower of Babel. So we played telephone with them to talk about how it's so fun when things sound different than you expect. And the first one was, my name is Bobby, and it turned into I am a dragon, which is awesome. And then the second one was, I am stupid, and it turned into not a good word. So some little sweet kid along the way was like, stupid is not a good word. And so he turned around and was like, not a good word. And that's what it turned into, which is just the sweetest thing. So like Joshua said, my name's Vanessa and I'm a cell leader. As you're signing the welcome list, there's going to be some slides. We have a common fund box over here that we share for people who have need and around the world. It's the black box, so if you want to share something, you can go over there, and while you're there, you can look at some information, too, about some of our partners. But I wanted to just share a little great thing about my cell. This last week, we've had, like, a lot of changes. We meet after the 7 p.m. on Sunday night, so, like, it always kind of changes a little bit, and there's usually not the same group one week as there is the last week. And we were kind of talking about, like, oh, it'd be so great to get to know each other better and try to do something to, like, go a little bit deeper. So I called a lot of people in cell this week, and the good thing was that they just all called me back. And I couldn't believe that. Like, my phone died this week because I've never talked that much in my life on the phone in one week, for real. And I don't know how to talk on the phone that well because I usually text or email, so I was, like, talking over people, you know, and you're like, and then you're like, no, you go, and I didn't know how to do it, and we just kept giggling about it on the phone, and I was like, we're talking about wanting to get to know each other more, and really, I feel very known this week, because, like, my most awkward, silly self that only wants to talk when I sound really good is totally coming out all week with these people in my cell, so that was a really great thing that happened in cell this week. Two things that I want to highlight going on. One is that this Wednesday is International Day of Prayer for Peace, the 21st. And it is a day when people around the world acknowledge a ceasefire and they stop using their guns and dropping bombs and everything. So it's a really beautiful day. Like, I feel like the spiritual world, there's, like, a lot of good things happening that day. And it's a day to participate in. And I think more things could happen that day than other days. Like magic or something. So we're doing a prayer vigil at 7 p.m. at Drexel Park on Wednesday with the Shalom House leading us. So it'll probably be like an hour, hour and a half or something. And we're going to pray for Philadelphia and the 7 sectors of society, which are based on Martin Luther King's nonviolent principles. So I'll be driving down from this neighborhood and would love to pick 4 people up. If you want to come, just talk to me afterwards, and we'll leave at 6:30 from here to go down there on Wednesday night. Another thing coming up in 3 Wednesdays is about making a covenant meeting. It's October 3rd, and that's at 7 p.m., and it's like a real creative name because it means about making a covenant. I mean, you go to hear what it means to make a covenant with Circle of Hope, so that's to become part of the family in a more intentional way. So even if you're intrigued by that and you don't think you're ready to make a covenant or you're not sure if you are, you can talk to me or Joshua or ask anyone else in this room, and someone can direct you to someone who knows what it would be like to go to that meeting and learn about what it would be to make a covenant. And the last thing I wanted to highlight is that every day we have a prayer on Circle of Hope, daily prayer. And just a few days ago, we started a new proverb with, like, a new secret writer. And it's just been really great the last few days. And I've had a hard time doing this on my own in the mornings. But I have a friend now that I call who lives in North Carolina. It was her idea. And we just read it through together for, like, 15 minutes. And we just stay silent on the phone for 5 minutes and then say goodbye. And that's our understanding, that's what we do, and it's so that we can help each other do it. And I mean, I mostly now only do this with other people instead of on my own, which is just a really great surprise to find out, like, halfway through the year that really helps a lot. So I just wanted to share that. Is there anything that you'd like to highlight that I missed? Jillian?
We had the baby goods exchange yesterday.
You're right.
There were 140 people coming through the doors.
So. And that didn't count, like, husbands and kids a lot of times.
Right.
Yeah.
So thank you to everybody who came and helped out, and
And thank you to Jillian, because she speaks Spanish, so she had Yo Hablo Español on her blouse, and that helped a lot. Anything else, Neil?
October 7th is this coming, first Friday. It's that we do every first Friday here in the lobby. There's refreshments, and we invite our community to come in our doors and, through any means necessary, show their creativity and our hospitality to our neighborhood.
Yes.
October 8th is going to be a housewarming party for the Abrahams, Matt and Kate.
Oh, fun.
Josh Grace and I are playing with a couple other musicians from the community. It's going to be really good. It's going to be themed as country music.
Really?
My father's coming up from Maryland. He's a professional musician. He's playing keyboard and singing.
Wow.
And there's going to be some crazy encore songs that everyone will know. It's going to be $5. It's going to be $5 at the door, donations to Matt and Kate Abraham to finish their house. And the neighborhood people from Emerald and Coral are in for free, but everyone else, if it's in the neighborhood, have to pay $5. It's 21 and above because there will be alcohol there.
Wow, that sounds so fun. Let's help Kate and Matt. Anything else? Let's sing this song one more time before we pray.
I'll listen to the first two verses together again.
For the last thing we're going to do is we're going to pray in solidarity with some Mi'kmaq people from Canada. There's some Aboriginal people from Canada who are working through a process of trying to reintroduce themselves to their roots. As we've been going through the season, I forgot to mention this at the five, but we're using this map to sort of track the different people. This is a little map failure. supposed to go up there, but next week there'll be a spot up to, it's the Quebec region of Canada. Anyway, Mi'kmaq or Mi'kmaq, as they're sometimes called, are a people group, like I said, from up that way. I had a clever thing I did before. I'm going to ignore that this time, but that's their symbol is actually this one here. That's the symbol of the nation. It's a more recent symbol. Some of these are a little bit more ancient, but they were heavily influenced by Christianity. And in that time, it was estimated that pre-Columbus there was about 60,000 Mi'kmaq. They were reduced down to about 6,000 in 16th century. These are all estimate numbers. But now they've actually come back quite a bit, and their numbers are around 40,000. But the groups particularly that we want to pray for, and this is more of an example of people from all over the world that are doing this kind of work. But there's two groups, if you're interested in just looking more into it, called iEmergence and My People International, and there's a family, the LeBlanc family, that has started these. But it's basically, you know, an indigenous people that are trying to not lose their faith in Jesus, but also reclaim their roots in their culture and blend those things together. So let's stand and pray for them. I'm going to read a prayer that was written by Guantalupe Baybaya, who is a indigenous theology worker working. He's from it's called the Indigenous Theology Working Group, but it's from Australia. He's an indigenous person from Australia. So let's pray. Holy Father, God of love, you are the creator of this land and of all good things. We acknowledge the pain and shame of our history and the sufferings of our peoples. We ask your forgiveness. We thank you for the survival of indigenous cultures. Our hope is in you because you gave your son Jesus to reconcile the world to you. We pray for your strength and grace to forgive, accept, and love one another as you love us and forgive and accept us in the sacrifice of your son. Give us the courage to accept the realities of our history so we may build a better future for our nation. Teach us to respect all cultures. Teach us to care for our land and our waters, and help us to care for our land and waters. Help us to share justly the resources of this land. Help us to bring about spiritual and social change to improve the quality of life for all groups in our communities, especially the disadvantaged. Help young people to find true dignity and self-esteem by your Spirit. May your power and love be the foundations on which we build our families, our communities, and our nation. Through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. Go in peace.